From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The stock market's down over 600 points after China announced tariff increases on $60 billion of American goods. The move was in retaliation for the White House's latest penalties on Chinese products. Also, a procession of Democratic presidential candidates are making their way to California to raise money. These and more political developments after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful weekend and particularly nice Mother's Day yesterday. A belated happy Mother's Day to all of you out there who are moms. Coming up later this hour, we're going to be taking a look at the life of Doris Day. She died this morning at age 97. The L.A. Film Critics Association honored her a few years back with their Lifetime Achievement Award. And Leonard Maltin, the terrific film historian and critic, is going to be with us to talk about Doris Day's legacy. He did, if not the last interview with her, one of the very last that she gave. So we're going to be talking with Leonard coming up a little bit later. But first, we begin with the news you just heard, the top NPR's hourly newscast. And that is the $60 billion in American goods that will see tariff hikes from the Chinese government. That in response to the Trump administration's announcement of U.S. duties on $200 billion of Chinese imports. And the stock market has responded quite dramatically, with the Dow down close to 700 points right now. Joining us to talk about the developments, Lonnie Chen, research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, and Matt Barreto of UCLA, where he's professor of political science. Lonnie, let me start with you. Are you hopeful they are going to reach a deal, the U.S. and China?
Well, Larry, I had been hopeful for some time. I think that the signs, at least going into last week, were quite positive. Now, it's really anyone's guess, because the fundamentals, I don't think, have changed, which is that a deal does good for both the United States and China. I do think China fundamentally needs a deal in the short run more than America does. That having been said, this whole thing has been thrown into disarray by the most recent escalation of tariffs by the president. And what's clear is that he believes that he's got some economic good news essentially to trade off against these escalation of this trade war. And you're seeing that already in the decline of the stock market. He obviously thinks, look, I can trade off some of the good news we've seen in the stock market recently in exchange for, quote, getting tough on China. I'm just not sure that the strategy at the end of the day is going to lead to the kind of deal he wants and, frankly, the kind of deal that our economy needs. So a lot of things, I think, have been thrown into disarray now, where people probably would have said, look, a deal can get done. Now I'm not so sure anymore.
Well, and I'm wondering about aspects of the president's base. Many farmers are going to be hard hit by this, and you've still got, to some degree, Republicans who are anti-tariff and are free traders. So how are those that otherwise support the president on other policies responding to his move here?
Yeah, it's a good question. It creates a ton of cross pressure. You've mentioned a couple of constituencies. Obviously, there are a number of constituencies who are in agricultural industries who would be supportive of the president, who've already said, look, these policies that you're pursuing toward China, this trade war escalation that you're pursuing is not beneficial to us. I'm thinking, for example, about a couple farming groups in Iowa, where obviously the president did well in 2016 politically, who have said this is really hurting us, it's really damaging us. Now, there's no indication that those people are saying we don't support you anymore, but they are saying that they don't believe this policy is the right approach. In a similar fashion, you've got a number of Republicans. Senator Rob Portman of Ohio comes to mind. As folks who are free traders, people who believe strongly in the value of free trade in benefiting our economy as well as economies around the world. And those folks have already said, look, it's going to be very difficult for us to continue to support the president in this regard. But obviously, more broadly, they still need to support the president as a general matter because of the politics of how he's playing on the Republican base. So it's a very interesting set of cross pressures. I predict you're going to see more and more Republican senators, in particular folks like Portman, who are free traders, begin to say, look, this is not a sustainable policy. Now, whether they're actually going to be motivated to do anything about it, the question is, what could Congress do? The answer is not a whole lot, because this ultimately is within the purview of the president and what he wants to do out of his office.
We're talking with Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, Matt Barreto, UCLA professor. Professor, good to have you with us this morning. This is sort of a strange policy issue for Trump, in that it also crosses over for some of the most progressive Democrats, and where they're, you know, definitely not in favor of free trade and looking to protect American workers. Your thoughts about how, you know, Democrats attempt to leverage, if they do, this issue?
Well, Democrats have long talked about trade as a fairness issue, not just related to how much each country is importing and exporting, the import-export deficit or balance that Trump likes to talk about, but other issues such as making sure that there are environmental protections in these other countries, that there are living wages in these other countries, that we're essentially not taking advantage of these developing countries by importing their cheap labor. And Trump is certainly not talking about it in those terms at all. He's just looking at a balance ledger and saying, hey, I don't like the fact that China's making money off of us. So I don't think there's any danger of it spilling over into that respect. I think there's still a lot of fertile ground for Democratic candidates to criticize this trade policy, because it is having negative effects, as Lonnie pointed out, on some constituencies here. First of all, prices are going to be going up on a lot of things, whether it's electronics. We saw a story over the weekend that the average price of all washing machines is up about $100 from the cheap end to the high end as a result of these tariffs and other aspects. Farmers are undoubtedly getting pressured. You know, we have the U.S. government now giving U.S. federal taxpayer subsidies just to sort of appease soybean farmers so that they, you know, don't have to let all of their crops go fallow. And the market could handle all of this. There's definitely a solution here that the market can handle if we let a fair and just trade policy go forward. And I think this so-called trade war is really preventing that, because you have escalating tensions on both sides, and it doesn't seem like there's an opportunity to negotiate right now.
Do you think that this is a place where Democrats can gain ground with voters that you know might be at play for them? I mean, I look, for example, at the Mueller report and the subpoenas to the Trump administration members. That, you know, that's probably not going to be convincing to people who are trying to decide. I'm wondering if this issue is one that Democrats could actually leverage come 2020.
I definitely think there are pocketbook issues, and this is certainly one of those, demonstrating that these tariffs have had an actual impact. It's not going to be hard to get people on record talking about how these trade policies with China have actually affected either them paying more for goods, or they're a small business owner that's now not able to sell their goods as effectively to China. I mean, that's a huge market that many small businesses and farmers in the U.S. want to access. And now, because of these policies, China is countering today with a 25% increase on tariffs on over 2,500 imports. And that's going to start on June 1st. So that's one. And I think related, there's another, which is the tax cuts. The tax cuts have not trickled down to the average consumer. They have been mostly felt by the top. And then the third is the cost of health care. So if Democrats focus on those three sort of pocketbook issues, I think there are people who maybe had supported Trump in 2016 and now are having second thoughts. They're thinking, what am I actually getting out of this other than a lot of saber rattling?
We're talking with UCLA professor Matt Barreto. He's also the co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He was policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign and Marco Rubio's 2016 campaign. But let's talk about what's going on with the impasse between House Democrats and the Trump administration. Bill Barr, the attorney general, not testifying testifying before the House Judiciary Committee, and the Justice Department has refused to release a completely unredacted copy of the Mueller report to members of Congress. Lonnie Chen with the administration saying, no, they're not going to comply with it. They're also not the administration not going to release the president's tax returns that have been subpoenaed as well. So is this all just going to have to take months, if not years, to play out through the courts?
Yeah, I do think, Larry, ultimately, that is the disposition of a lot of this, is it's going to have to be litigated in the courts. I mean, I think we saw this when there was a conflict between the executive branch and Congress during the Obama administration, when, for example, the Justice Department refused to turn over paperwork and evidence relating to the so-called Fast and Furious program, which was the controversial program that eventually placed some illicit firearms in the hands of Mexican drug lords. That particular program, there was controversy over. The White House and the Justice Department did not want to turn over certain documents, and so that ended up being litigated in up to and including a contempt holding against then Attorney General Eric Holder. In a similar way, although the facts in this case are obviously different, there are disagreements between the White House and the executive branch and the Congress regarding what information ought to be turned over, what is appropriate disclosure, and the courts are the right venue for that conversation, and I think that's where it's going to go. The notion of it being a constitutional crisis, which is what some have called it, seems a little bit over-torqued to me. I think this is clearly a conflict between branches, but to call it a constitutional crisis, I think, is probably beyond the pale.
Yeah, Matt, what do you think? Do you think that rhetorical term constitutional crisis is accurate?
I think we're definitely headed in that direction. I mean, here's the issue. Trump is used to operating in a completely non-democratic environment where he operates as the sole decider over his business. It's one of the reasons he settles so often, that he prefers to keep his matters completely private and out of the public view. So now what we're seeing is the Democratic House is doing all the same things that the Republican House did to Obama and Hillary Clinton. And it is true, as Lonnie said, that there are some items in which the House committees tried to compel Obama and he used occasional executive privilege. But that was occasional. By comparison, Trump is making this the rule, not the exception. He's leading with that. He's instructing openly via Twitter and other things his executive administrators to not comply with the House oversight. And then the House has the constitutional power of oversight. And so I think that is what is getting people worried. Not that there are some times that an executive agency might not say, there's privilege here, we don't need to turn those over. But it shouldn't be the rule that you publicly brag about leading with, that you're not going to comply with these things. And certainly some of these things need to get settled by courts. And it seems like we're going in that direction. The House is holding people in contempt. They're going to vote on that on the full floor in a little while. And so it is an important debate, and I wish that more conservative constitutional scholars would weigh in and say, regardless of who's in charge, this is not what the framers set up. They set up co-equal branches of government. Yeah, and let's try to get more into this, because we don't want to get into a situation where the Democrats are so upset when they get the White House that they say, hey, new rules. We don't have to comply. We won't send any of our people to testify. We're not turning over any documents. That would be bad for our democracy.
Well, and yet, in fairness to the president, though, I mean, you're describing a series of areas where he's dug in his heels in not cooperating with Congress. But when it came to Mueller's investigation, as I recall, in Mueller's report, he said that he was not thwarted by the White House in conducting it, even though, according to the report, he had asked Don McGahn to fire Mueller. He didn't do so. And so what was arguably the deepest dive into the most critical allegation against his campaign, that did proceed. So is it fair to say that at every turn he's been an obstructionist?
Well, if that's the case, then there should be no issue in turning over the unredacted Mueller report, at least to Congress, and to let them look at it if there's nothing problematic in there. I think the perception from the public is that when there's an issue, and especially from Nadler and Schiff and other Democrats in the House, when there's an issue, the president's inclination, especially a public issue, the president's inclination is to block them and to not cooperate with them. And if he is being cooperative, then he should get credit for that. But it does not appear to be the case, because they're now trying to block the full Mueller report from coming out and even giving it to Congress behind the scenes. They don't want to do that.
Yeah. Lonnie, your thoughts on the president. Also, Matt brought up the point about, you know, conservative Republican legal scholars who've been critical of the president's approach on this.
Yeah, I mean, there is clearly a need here for the branches in this situation in particular, for the executive to realize that there's a certain amount of disclosure, there's a certain amount of oversight to be conducted that is reasonable and certainly, you know, fine, that they should be complying with. With respect to the Mueller report, I mean, it gets a little bit complicated, because the reality is there are two categories of redactions. One category of redactions are those relating to pending grand jury investigations, those which the attorney general has said they will not turn over to Congress a copy of the unredacted report that includes disclosures relating to grand jury investigations, because it would be a violation of federal law. That seems sound to me. The other category are redactions relating to third parties who may be innocent, may not be innocent, but may be innocent, and therefore their identities are being protected from public scrutiny. Those redactions, Barr has indicated he's willing to allow Congress to see in closed session. It seems to me that Democrats should take up the attorney general on his offer to allow for that, and recognize that there is some information which still needs to be protected because of ongoing investigations. So it's always a little bit more complicated than simply saying, look, the attorney general doesn't want to turn things over and this is a crisis. The reality is that there is some nuance here that I think the two sides are trying to get to, and hopefully both Republicans and Democrats will act in good faith so that they can get what information they need without turning this into a further political circus.
We're talking with Lonnie Chen and Matt Barreto, our political experts this week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke to reporters late last week about the ongoing impasse between the White House and Democratic leaders in Congress.
Trump is goading us to impeach him. That's what he's doing. Every single day, he's just like taunting, because he knows that it would be very divisive in the country, but he doesn't really care. Just wants to solidify his base. That might have been too political, so you know, criticize me for that. But that's what it is. So we can't impeach him for political reasons, and we can't not impeach him for political reasons. But we have to see where the facts take us.
So Nancy Pelosi strikes me being, you know, very candid about the difficult position in which Democrats find themselves, and the way in which a potential impeachment vote in the House could actually play to President Trump. Matt, your thoughts. I mean, does that have the potential of making Trump, for some, a sympathetic figure?
Well, I think that Pelosi's right here, that Trump is really trying to egg the Democrats on in this case. And that might be why he's been so public on some of his reluctance to let his folks testify. It is going to be a political storm if that happens. And it would give Trump a rallying cry for his base. How effective it will be would be based on the evidence. If there's some really damning evidence, it may not be that good of a rallying cry. But still, when he's under attack, when he's saying they're trying to impeach me, it does give him a call to his base. And I think the Democrats feel that they made a very strong case in 2018 by running on health care and pointing out Trump was the one who was being divisive and trying to attack people, whether it was the migrant caravan or other things. And they feel that that was effective, and they don't want to give up on that very effective campaign strategy. But at the same time, you know, evidence mounts, perhaps most critically related to the emoluments clause and whether or not Trump can enrich himself while he's in the office. And there are certainly those that do want to see these investigations go forward. So Pelosi's in a very difficult position, but I think at this point she's still playing it right.
Well, and Lonnie, do these issues move the needle much with the electorate? I mean, impeachment then would raise it to such a high profile level. It seems to me that could have an impact on 2020, but I wonder if anything short of impeachment does.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the problem, and that's the challenge for Pelosi, is that raising the issue of impeachment, or actually moving forward to impeachment, not raising it, but actually moving forward to a vote on impeachment, does take it to a very different level. And I think it satisfies a certain constituency. I mean, there are people who are going to be Democratic primary voters, for example, not all of them, but some of them, who care intensely about this issue. And I think it would be satisfying to them. But it's not clear that beyond that population, this move politically makes a lot of sense. And I have to give Pelosi a ton of credit here, because she's really one of the few Democrats, and she's in a very important position as Speaker, but one of the few Democrats who really sort of understands the difficult dynamic that this issue poses for her caucus, for the party, and for presidential politics. So,
and
Nancy
she's
Pelosi,
talking about it, which is, well, I think quite interesting that she's being upfront about it.
Yeah, but I think it speaks to her savvy, and I think she doesn't get nearly enough credit for what she's doing here, which is warning her own party about the dangers of proceeding down that road.
We're talking with Lonnie Chen, also with us Matt Barreto, as we talk about the top political developments of the past several days. President Trump facing a number of foreign policy tests, U.S. seizing a North Korean ship, Iran threatening more uranium enrichment if there's not a renegotiated nuclear deal, the continuing lack of stability in Venezuela. All of these are challenges. Matt, your thoughts about where we stand with these, and on the political side, are any of these international issues ones that voters are going to be strongly considering?
Well, I think if you think about it as an overall strategy, it appears that related to where we started the conversation with the trade war with China, which is also an international issue, that Trump is now pursuing really a policy of chaos. And that's how it's been described in many of the news reports over what's happening. And that possibly could play into his base, that if there is tension, if there is anxiety over what's happening in the world, that's something that he is going to sell to his base as why he needs to continue to be a tough guy. This is certainly the image that he sort of sells. Now, on the other hand, he promoted himself in 2016 as the king of negotiations. He talked about how awful the Iran deal was and that he would immediately be able to get a new one. He talked about trade deals with China, which he has failed on. He talked about North Korea and other issues. And so far, we haven't seen those negotiating skills sort of be fulfilled and offer us anything. So there could be a danger there. But I think it's part of a strategy that he's really trying to sow this chaos and that will encourage his base to feel that they need to come together and support him. And let's just hope that nothing awful happens in the meantime, because some of these things are certainly very dangerous, especially as they relate to North Korea and Iran.
And interesting to see the distance also that exists between the president's own members of his cabinet and his own policies, and to see openly in public the sort of disagreement in the way some of these international issues are framed. Lonnie, quick thought on this before we move to the Democratic candidates.
Well, just two quick things. One is, you see the division, as you say, within this administration. I mean, Larry Kudlow, the chief economics advisor, over the weekend saying, look, these China tariffs are going to hurt both sides. And I think that's not a view that the president has seen as a prevailing one. The other point I'll just make is foreign policy and elections tends really not to be the issue unless, as Matt alludes to, there's some really bad episode that happens and really horrible thing. Then it does become an issue. But by and large, it's not something people pay a ton of attention to when they're thinking about who they want to pick for president.
And then, of course, the question is, is the economy, which has performed so strongly under President Trump, going to be the historically pocketbook driven voting, or are all the other things that are associated with the Trump presidency going to supersede the strong performance of the economy? Lonnie, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, traditionally, I would say that the economy is the most important factor in predicting what's going to happen, and less about the absolute state of the economy and more about the trend line. So if you think back to 2012, the election I was a part of with Mitt Romney, the economy was not doing great. But in 2012, it was improving and doing better than it had in 2011. And that was a huge factor, a good tailwind at President Obama's back. In a similar way, the economy looks very strong right now for President Trump. The question is, how is it going to look this time next year? If the economy is on a downward trajectory for some reason, we're seeing slowing growth and unemployment beginning to creep back up, that upward pressure on wages coming back down, then I think the president could be in for some political difficulty. It all depends on the trend. But by and large, the economy is a very, very important factor to consider.
And he's you know, he's going to be stressing that during the campaign if the numbers, as you say, are still in his favor. Matt, your thoughts about that? And does Trump have the ability, as he campaigns heading toward 2020, sort of shift the perception of Americans about the economy? Because it seems there's been a lag between the public's perceptions of what's going on versus its numeric performance.
No, he absolutely does not have the ability to do that. And the reason is that in 2018, he should have only been talking about how low unemployment was. But instead, he decided to call these refugees and asylum seekers criminals, rapists, and invaders. I mean, there's no chance that he's going to run on unemployment, which is ridiculous because it's going to be at historic lows in 2020.
And wages are
instead,
going up finally.
Yeah, and instead he's got us the economic issue on the news is the one we spent 10 minutes talking about, how he has a self-created trade war with China. So no, I'm not worried about that at all. He's going to continue, you know, attacking people and distracting people, and he's going to forget that unemployment is so low.
Matt Barreto, UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies, he's co-founded the polling and research firm Latino Decisions. Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution, where he's research fellow and an advisor on both the Rubio 2016 presidential campaign and the Romney 2012 campaign. Well, let's talk about the Democratic candidates for 2020 as they are making a procession through California, doing fundraisers, doing public events. And this, of course, puts California elected officials a bit on the spot because we're so early and the field is so huge. They have to figure out, well, you know, who am I tying myself to? What about Kamala Harris, who's the favorite daughter from California's candidate? You know, what do you do in terms of her high profile, strong candidacy? Matt, you know, your thoughts about this and sort of where it leaves elected officials here in California?
Well, I think there's two reasons now that California is relevant. It used to only be one, and that was fundraising. But now, as you said, because California's moved up and is on March 3rd on Super Tuesday and has the most delegates at stake of any state, California is relevant. You come out for fundraisers. You come out to meet people. You come out to do public events. And I think it's very important. Certainly, Harris has a name recognition advantage here in California. But as we saw in Texas, you know, Beto, in a poll that came out, was not leading Texas at this point. So just because you're the most known doesn't mean you're going to lead. People are looking at who they want to be president. But the candidates who are coming out here, if they're coming out for fundraisers, they need to make sure that they're also engaging in events, that they're in the community, that they're talking to voters, because that March 3rd Super Tuesday is going to be critical. Whoever comes away with a lead in California really is going to get a huge boost and get a lot of delegates.
Let's listen to Pete Buttigieg. He's the South Bend, Indiana mayor and 2020 presidential candidate. He was in L.A. this weekend raising money.
And if anybody tells you they're not sure whether America is capable in these twisted and dark times of delivering or vindicating our hopes, tell them you saw at the Abbey in West Hollywood a top-tier presidential candidate on his way to the White House moments after his husband introduced him to come onto the stage.
So Pete Buttigieg stands out for a number of reasons, one of them being that he's an openly gay candidate, as you mentioned, with his husband there at that event. Lonnie Chen, that seems to me to be something that's a big advantage in terms of visibility, you know, singular presence as a candidate. He seems to campaign in a way that really connects with people. Your thoughts, Lonnie, about Buttigieg's, chances here to continue with the momentum he's got?
Well, look, I think he is a very interesting candidate for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, you have somebody who clearly is operating, I think, at least on the campaign trail at a different level. His level of dialogue, the way he's able to engage issues, even the way that he seemed to shrug off some criticism from President Trump, referring to him as an Alfred E. Newman candidate. Yes. And I thought Buttigieg had a very clever reply, essentially alluding to the president's age as a response. So he's operating, I think, at a very high level. The question is that the level the Democratic electorate, the Democratic primary electorate, wants their nominee to be operating at? In other words, there's an intellectual sort of appeal to him that I think people enjoy and like in certain circles. The question is, does it have mass appeal? So that's sort of the first issue. The second issue is I think he is demonstrating how a certain level of earnestness, or at least perceived earnestness, is useful. And I think you're seeing this in the response that he gets from elected officials who are interested in meeting with him. You saw some commentary from Governor Gavin Newsom, who said, "I'd love to meet with him," even though Newsom has been publicly supportive of Kamala Harris. And others in a similar way are put in a difficult position here in California, because I think were Buttigieg or were some others not in the race, it would make someone like Harris sort of the automatic person they would go to. But now it does put them in sort of a difficult bind, because you've got this interesting candidate who really has a background quite unlike any other Democratic presidential candidate of the past. And they're being forced to respond to this while also dealing with the fact that there's tremendous pressure probably by Kamala Harris and those in her camp to be with her in this campaign. So it does create a really interesting dynamic for the Democrats. But Buttigieg has been interesting because he mixes all of these different elements of background together, former military. He's gay, but he's also an evangelical Christian. So he's not easy to characterize or put in a box, and I think that's what makes him interesting.
And, mayor of a college town in the Midwest. It's a very interesting mix. Just to elaborate a bit on the exchange between President Trump and Buttigieg at a rally last week, the president referred jokingly to Buttigieg as an Alfred E. Newman, who was a character created for Mad Magazine back in the 1960s. And he'd have the little, word blurb, "What, me worry?" For Alfred E. Newman. And Buttigieg said, "Who's Alfred E. Newman? This must be a generational thing." Mad Magazine, which is still published, came out with a gag page, "Who's Pete Buttigieg?" And as their response to it. But Matt Barreto, your thoughts about the candidates coming through, and particularly, Buttigieg, does he have the ability to detract from Harris's candidacy?
Well, I think he's definitely run a very good campaign, as Lonnie said. What he's done better than others is rise up above where he started. Now, he started, if you remember, running for the DNC chairmanship position and didn't get that far, but it gave him a little head start. It gave him a little taste of what to do on the national stage. And he's been able to position himself in a way to attract media attention in a mostly positive way. He's used criticism of Vice President Pence and sometimes to get more attention. And he has not campaigned as the openly gay candidate. He's talked about that as if it was just a normal thing, which it is. And so that by itself is bringing even more attention into a state like California. So he's certainly one to watch, but I would expect that Vice President Biden is probably still at the top of most lists. He's got very high name recognition, and most Democrats look back on the Obama-Biden years with fondness. So I would expect him to be a heavy hitter as well.
And do you feel like even before we get into the thick of the debates, some of these candidates are going to start winding down? I mean, it does look like Beto O'Rourke is having a difficult time. He came out of the box so fast, and then it seems like he's just sort of falling off the radar. Do you think you're going to see that with other candidates?
Well, we're going to see in the debates how many people make the debates and how many people sort of come out of the debates with new momentum or new energy. And that will be determined by their post-debate fundraising numbers and post-debate appearances on Sunday talk shows. At some point, that field is going to get narrowed down from 25 or so down to about probably 10 or so who really are strong. Iowa and New Hampshire also have that effect. It's very difficult to run in those states. But the wild card this year is that Super Tuesday is so early and it has big states like California and Texas. And so that's going to encourage candidates like Beto O'Rourke or Julian Castro to stay in a bit longer than they might be able to, Cory Booker and others, because they think they can compete in South Carolina or Texas or California. So I think the diversity of the states and the compactness of the schedule might allow some of the candidates to stay in a bit longer. And that's a good thing. That gives more choice to voters. They get to hear from more perspectives. And it will encourage more people to get involved and take part in the Democratic primaries.
It's going to be so interesting to see the gap, however large it is, between what happens on social media and the attention that, for lack of a better term, mainstream media pays to social media versus what really happens with rank and file Democratic voters. And, you know, Matt, you do this professionally. You're a pollster, among other things. Do you think there is a significant gap there and that we're perhaps being a bit led astray by who's getting attention now?
Well, the attention drives more attention. And so by getting that attention either in traditional media or mainstream media or social media, digital or other places, that's a good thing for the candidates because they can bring more awareness. They're still introducing themselves to people. Absent Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, the rest of them are still introducing themselves to people. They want to grow that fundraising base, and eventually that should transfer over into votes. It doesn't automatically. I mean, look what happened with Jeb Bush. He had a lot of money and he didn't get very many votes, but at this early point, the more attention you can get, the more you can raise your profile, the more you're in front of new audiences. And that's what the candidates are looking for right now. And I think that's the invisible primary. The longer they go, some of them aren't going to be able to cut it. Some of them are going to fall out and not get that attention. But they need to have that strategy now in 2020. They absolutely have to have a strong strategy for not just mainstream media and booking the Sunday shows, but for social media and making sure you're raising your awareness with activists and the louder voices.
And that's maybe going to be the biggest challenge for Joe Biden. Matt Barreto, thank you as always. Lonnie Chen, we appreciate it as well. Appreciate your being with us, gentlemen. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up right after our update, we're going to remember Doris Day, the actor and singer who died at the age of 97 this morning here in Northern California. We'll be back after this live update from Tammy Trujillo.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, "What will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich?" Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera.
Doris Day died this morning in Northern California, Carmel, at the age of 97. Day was one of the biggest movie stars of the 1950s and 60s, starring in a string of musicals and romantic comedies, many of them alongside Rock Hudson, who was her longtime friend right up until his death from complications related to AIDS. Let's listen to a clip of Doris Day alongside Rock Hudson, the 1959 film Pillow Talk.
Miss Morrow, why are you so fascinated with my personal affairs?
I'm not fascinated, Mr. Allen. Revolted.
You don't see me going down to the phone company complaining about your affairs.
I have none to complain about.
It figures.
What do you mean it figures?
Well, obviously, you're a woman who lives alone, doesn't like it.
I happen to like living alone.
Look, I don't know what's bothering you, but don't take your bedroom problems out on me.
I have no bedroom problems. There's nothing in my bedroom that bothers me.
Oh, that's too bad.
Doris Day, Rock Hudson from Pillow Talk of 1959. Leonard Maltin, film historian and critic, author of numerous books, and just having hosted his Maltin Fest at the American Cinematheque. Leonard also knew Doris Day and interviewed her. Leonard, thank you for being with us this morning.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Larry.
So, first of all, your thoughts about her personally. You had a chance to speak with her, to interview her. What impressed you most from those conversations?
I can't pretend to have been a friend, you know, or even an acquaintance, but I spent one memorable day with her up in Carmel in 1993 for Entertainment Tonight. She was hosting a fundraiser for her Doris Day Animal League, and she was exactly what you wanted Doris Day to be. She was delightful, unpretentious, warm, and to use the word that keeps coming to mind, sunny. She had a sunny personality.
And clearly was, in her friendship with Rock Hudson, an influential figure with the whole AIDS crisis, because when so many people had stereotypes about people with AIDS and there were fears about you know, being physically close to someone who was dealing with HIV or AIDS, you know, Doris Day, in her friendship with Rock Hudson, with the interview, when he was willing to come on, where you could see the physical ravages of the illness, it was very influential.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just one, you know, chapter in her life, but it had great repercussions.
All right. Leonard Maltin with us to talk about the legacy of Doris Day. So Day began as a big band singer. She performed with Les Brown and his orchestra. She was discovered at a party, as I understand, Leonard. You shed any light on that story as how she came to Hollywood's attention?
Only that she was on a very, very popular radio station that was they used to call it a clear channel signal out of Cincinnati, her hometown. WLW was a launch pad for a number of future stars. And she had, this very appealing voice. And then when it turned out that she had, you know, great looks to match her great voice, it was a no-brainer for her to get hired, and Les Brown hired her, and they had a tremendous hit in the song Sentimental Journey,
which we're going to hear a little bit later. One of the things I think about when I think of Day and her legacy, Leonard, is that there really isn't a Doris Day type. She was so created such a unique character. I mean, to the point that Oscar Levant, the noted wit, raconteur, and musician, said, "I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin." That there was sort of no one else like her in the role that she played in films.
Yes, it's true. Well, I mean, and yet she typified what was the kind of female roles being written at that time. She wasn't unique in that. I think she was perhaps unique in extending her career as long as she did, playing these very wholesome young women. She was often married in these films. She parried with her leading men, especially in those Rock Hudson comedies, which are very well written. In fact, screenplay for Pillow Talk won the Oscar that year for Best Original Screenplay. But she also, she starred in some serious dramas. She played the singer Ruth Etting opposite Jimmy Cagney in a memorable film, Love Me or Leave Me. She starred in a thriller called Midnight Lace. She wasn't a one-trick pony, so to speak. But people seem to pigeonhole her, perhaps unfairly.
Let's listen to her starring role with Jimmy Stewart in the Alfred Hitchcock 1956 film, The Man Who Knew Too Much.
All the way home, we'll be riding on Herbie Taylor's ulcers.
And Alida Markle's asthma.
Now, if we could just get four cases of the seven-year itch, we could retire. Or if Mrs. Yarr was really going to have triplets, we could completely redecorate the house, couldn't we?
What would they say if they heard us?
You know, one of the reasons I came to a place like Marrakesh is so we could say things like that without everybody hearing us.
Well, I'd like to say something where nobody could hear us.
Well, this is the safest place.
When are we going to have another baby? You're the doctor. You have all the answers.
Yeah, but this is the first time I've ever heard the question.
Jimmy Stewart, Doris Day, The Man Who Knew Too Much from Alfred Hitchcock in 1956. If you'd like to weigh in on the legacy of Doris Day, she was also a tremendous animal rights philanthropist, and that was what she devoted her later years to at her home in Carmel. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Doris Day performing Easy as Pie with the Les Brown Orchestra, 1941. Let's listen to a bit of it and then back in a minute.
Let me tell you something, it's like rolling off a load. When your feet start to beat to the heat of the rhythm, you can do wonders with them. They will really smoke and that's not you. Let yourself go. Do it in the hurry, get out of low. Get in too high, let yourself go. Baby, never worry, you can learn as easy as pie.
Doris Day, back with more on Doris Day in 1 minute on Air Talk.
Gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna set my heart at ease. Gonna make a sentimental journey to renew old memories.
The first big hit for Doris Day with Les Brown's orchestra, that from 1941. It was a huge hit. And from there, she launched an acting career, a star, alongside so many great actors, Cary Grant and others, Jimmy Stewart, also known for a number of co-starring roles with Rock Hudson and her very close friend for many years. Doris Day passed away at her Carmel Valley home at the age of 97. Her Animal Rights Foundation announced her death today. She, according to the foundation, been in excellent physical health for her age of 97, but recently contracted pneumonia, and she's requested no memorial service and no grave marker be erected as well. Let's take a call. This comes from Jeffrey in Beverly Hills. You're on Air Talk. Your thoughts of Doris Day?
Yes, her dramatic talents were never so apparent as in Midnight Lace, which Mr. Maltin mentioned. There is a scene in which she simulates a nervous breakdown, but it is so real and so harrowing. I wouldn't be surprised if her co-stars, Rex Harrison and Myrna Loy, weren't aghast witnessing it live. It's almost painful to watch, but such intense acting.
Hey, thank you, Jeffrey. I appreciate you sharing that. Also with us, our film critic, Wade Major. Wade, thank you for being with us. You want to follow up on Jeffrey's point?
You know, I was looking at Leonard as well, and Jeffrey. She was such a rich actress and had so many layers to her. I agree that certainly that's where you see some of her real dramatic chops. But what always impressed me was that she came on as a musical actress originally, but she didn't have to do musicals. She could do it all. And the only other actress I can think of that sort of satisfied all of that earlier was Ginger Rogers. And I've always felt that Doris Day kind of picked up the mantle of Ginger Rogers and carried it into the 50s and 60s and became that iconic actress for the post-war era, which is where all of the great actresses of the pre-war era kind of started to fade, whether it was Judy Garland or Betty Davis, whoever it was a new era, and Doris Day represented that new America, that America in a safer, more prosperous world.
And I think it was, 2011, something like that, that the LA Film Critic Association gave her the Life Achievement Award.
We did, and it was electronically. She didn't leave Carmel, so we had a Skype session with her, and it was just, she was lovely, and it was, I think, a very special moment for everybody to be able to sort of have her there, even though she wasn't there physically, yeah.
Janet in Mar Vista. Janet, briefly, your comment, please.
Well, to echo what the the caller from Beverly Hills, her underrated drama, and she was so earthy. I think that's what struck me. I mean, as compared to like Grace Kelly, who was just sort of, you know, in Hitchcock, just sort of lightweight. She had such an earthiness. And also in Man Who Knew Too Much, her dramatic scenes when her son is missing. She was just great. She was just so earthy. And that's...
Yeah. Janet, I'm very glad that you mentioned that. Thank you. Also with us, Britt Alcroft, the creator of Thomas and Friends, the wonderful children's series. And Britt, thank you for calling in. You spent time with Doris?
Yes, I did. When I was little, she was the sunshine of my life. And I had a scrapbook that I made with pictures of her, and I painted stars on it and all the rest of it. And on my first trip to L.A., actually in 77, just by thought, you never know, I took the book with me. And as it turned out, one thing and another happened, and I ended up saying that she wanted to meet me, and we sat in a dark corner in Trader Vic's. And she looked, she said, show it to me. I showed it to her, and she teared up. And she said, could I borrow this for the night and look at it? And I said, of course you can. And I said to her, you know, you are just the heroine of so many lives. And she looked at me and she said, really? And I said, yes, really. And she said, you know what? She said, I never thought about myself like that. I always felt I was the lunchbox lady who went to work and came home. And she said, I really will treasure this. And she did. And I got it back the day later. And she'd written me a beautiful message in it. And I still got it, Larry.
Wow. Britt, thank you for sharing that memory. I appreciate it very much. Also want to thank Leonard Maltin, film critic and historian, for being with us, and Wade Major, our Film Week critic as well. We close out this, of course, great performance, Secret Love. It was an Oscar-winning song from the 1953 film Calamity Jane.
All too soon, my secret love became impatient to be free.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. Coming up later this hour, I'd like to hear from you if you have had a very difficult time forgiving someone who did something truly awful to you. Or maybe you were able to work through and find that way of forgiving the person for doing something that was really terrible. Steve Scalise, the member of Congress, number two ranking Republican in the House, you might recall a couple of years ago they were having a baseball practice in suburban D.C. and a guy opened fire on the members of Congress as they were practicing. Scalise was nearly killed and has suffered lasting physical injuries as a result of that traumatic experience. And he was saying last week that he's having a very difficult time forgiving the man who shot him. And he had a conversation, which was very helpful, with one of the pastors of one of those three African-American churches that was burned in what's alleged to be a hate crime arson incident. So we're going to talk about whether something someone said to you or what it was that helped you, if you had a particularly traumatic experience at the hands of another, how you reached that place of forgiveness. But we begin with the U.S. Supreme Court decision announced this morning on a 5-4 split that consumers can pursue lawsuits against Apple for allegedly artificially inflating prices in its App Store. The case is Apple versus Pepper. Apple collects a 30% cut of each purchase that takes place at its App Store. And so the question is, what sort of effect does this have on iOS users and on Apple itself? With us is Brent Kendall, the Wall Street Journal legal affairs reporter. He's based in the D.C. Bureau. Brent, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So elaborate a bit on the issues that were at play in this case.
Sure. Well, I guess I would start out by just saying it. This is sort of the first early word in the case. It's a key word, and today's decision was a big one, but the court didn't wade into today whether Apple, in fact, violated antitrust laws through how it sells apps for the iPhones. The question in this case is whether consumers even had the right to sue Apple. So, I mean, this case dates back pretty much since Apple's been selling apps for the iPhone in 2007. And, you know, you can only buy apps for the iPhone through Apple. And so this consumer suit alleges that, you know, because Apple is the exclusive marketplace for its apps, that, you know, this monopoly power has allowed it to do things that, in terms of pricing, that it wouldn't otherwise be able to do, including, you know, the 30% commission, and there are other rules like requiring that app sellers make their offerings end in the price of 99 cents. So if you had an app and wanted to sell it, say, for 50 cents, you couldn't do it that way.
And does this open up the door for app developers to sue as well, or just users of iOS, apps that run on iOS?
Well, it can be both. Developers would have separate claims, and the opinion today makes clear that they should be able to sue. And part of what Apple argued was that the developers would be the ones to sue anyway and not consumers. I mean, what's really at issue here is some past Supreme Court precedent about, you know, when there are these kind of violations, who is the party that's harmed and should be able to seek and collect damages. So Apple argued a couple things here. One was that it didn't really set the prices. Developers still controlled the prices within certain parameters, and so it shouldn't be sued. And then it argued also that, you know, really, developers were contracting with Apple for this marketplace, and so if anybody had a claim, it would be the developers. And so they relied on past cases that barred suits by what are called indirect purchasers. So say if you had an automaker who fixed prices on a component of a car and then sold that component and somebody else put it in the car and then the car got sold to you. Under this rule, normally only the people who purchased the component directly would be able to sue, not the end-use consumer. And so Apple said, well, this is kind of the same thing. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not right. You know, Apple, you are selling these apps directly to consumers. Therefore, you know, they have a right to sue you if you're violating the law. So again, this is, you know, the first big word in the case. But I mean, if consumers did win down the line, I mean, A, Apple could be facing a pretty hefty antitrust damages. And, you know, it could change the way that apps are bought and sold for at least for Apple customers.
We're talking with Wall Street Journal reporter Brent Kendall, also with us from Reuters, San Francisco-based technology correspondent Stephen Nellis. Stephen, thank you very much. I mean, it seems to me one of the things that appeals to users of Apple products is that it's sort of this self-contained safe space and that all the apps are vetted by Apple and you don't have to worry about stuff. So if the other edge of that sword is that then Apple can exploit that to monetize that sort of safe playground, how in future lawsuits are those competing forces likely to play out?
Well, that's a good question, Larry. You're certainly right that Apple has presented this as a major feature of the iPhone. I think if you're thinking about buying a device for, you know, a grandparent or somebody who's not as familiar with technology, this is a selling point, right? The only thing that can go on this device is something that that Apple has vetted and that you know is supposedly going to be safe. I do think we may see Apple present that, not so much in the legal sense, but in the court of public opinion. If they do end up having to face an antitrust claim, this will probably be a key component that they're keeping people safe by vetting everything that goes in their store. And then I also think that this has been a major business selling point for them, that they're going to say the reason this product is so successful is that we control it. As to how we'll actually see that play out in the claims, you know, as Brent explained, this is highly technical questions of law, so it's probably not as big an element of the legal claims there as it would be for the court of public opinion. But I do think we could see something along the lines of Apple, you know, saying that it would have to make significant changes to its operating system, and that they would have to pass those costs along to consumers, et cetera.
Do you know, is there much of a price difference between purchasing an app through Apple Store versus through the Play Store for Android devices? Does the same app that's sold both places for the two different platforms, does it typically cost differently between the two?
So the difference is more in the platforms than the prices themselves. Google Play's pricing is very similar in as much as they charge a 30% cut of a discrete purchase. There's some different prices for subscriptions. But the primary difference is that if you own an Android device, there are other ways to get applications and software onto that device except for the Google Play Store. Now, this isn't as common here in the United States, but if you look in other parts of the world, like China, for example, most of the major quote-unquote app stores there are actually run by third parties and not Google itself, and they're doing huge and booming businesses of putting applications and services onto Android devices outside of the context of the Google Play Store. That's just a key difference between the way that Android works and the way that the iPhone works. But, you know, you can definitely see the difference in pricing on the iPhone between getting a software or a service through the App Store versus not in things like Spotify or Netflix. You'll notice that both of those companies, which are very popular with U.S. consumers, have said you're going to have to go to Spotify.com or Netflix.com and input your credit card information directly there and have the direct billing relationship with us on our website. And then when you get our app on the App Store, it's basically just going to be a dumb login screen where you put in your username and password and access your account. And the reason that they've done that is because if Spotify were to enable you to sign up for their service on the iPhone, they would have to pay 30% of that to Apple. And in the past, they've actually had different pricing. They've said Spotify costs $13 if you sign up through the iOS app, or it costs $10 if you sign up on our website. Now, they've recently discontinued doing that practice and actually filed a complaint against Apple over this exact thing in the European Union.
We're talking with Stephen Nellis of Reuters, Brent Kendall of The Wall Street Journal, about the Supreme Court decision announced this morning that Apple can be sued in lower courts for the way it operates its App Store and the exclusivity of apps that will run on their iOS platforms, particularly the iPhone, have to be purchased through the App Store, where Apple takes that 30% cut. As you just heard, Google also takes a 30% cut with things that are sold on the Google Play Store, but that users of the Android operating system are able to access non-Google Play vended apps and can get those at lower cost should they choose to do so. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brent, I assume for Apple, you know, one of the big risks here is with iPhone sales slowing down significantly, people now keeping their phones longer, there being less of a difference from generation to generation of new phones. The apps are where they're really making their money.
That's true. And so, you know, if this case ends up upending their business model, I mean, you know, that's a significant slice of revenue for them that, you know, at least comes under pressure. And, you know, if they again have to open up how they do these sales, you know, they run the risk of losing the 30% commission fees on top of this. And, you know, if people get conditioned to buying apps in the other way, I mean, you know, at least potentially down the road, it could make Apple less than a central player on how apps get distributed, you know, for its own phones. I mean, obviously, we're still a ways away here. I mean, you know, and on the financial side, in addition to that, I mean, the other thing to keep in mind here is, you know, look, since 2007, Apple has sold billions and billions of dollars of apps. And the plaintiffs allege that, you know, that all of those were priced higher than they would have been had Apple not had a monopoly on how these things are sold. And so, I mean, who knows, potentially down the line, if this case were litigated all the way to a verdict, and then Apple lost, what kind of damages you might be looking like. And under antitrust law, any damages in an antitrust case are tripled. So the damages were found to be, you'd multiply that by three, and you know that's a pretty big number.
We're going to, in our next segment, take up the issue of the co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, saying it's time to break up the company and that it runs afoul of antitrust laws. Brent, is, you know, someone who covers antitrust among your legal affairs beat here, your thoughts on whether today's Supreme Court ruling relates to that issue of whether Facebook would potentially be in violation of antitrust laws?
You know, I think there are two separate questions. I mean, so there's one question. I mean, so I think a lot of what people are talking about Facebook, I mean, is entirely separate and unaffected by today's ruling. I mean, I will say today's ruling, you know, does have some potential broader import because courts are still grappling with, you know, how to work through cases where you have consumers on digital platforms. You know, you have what are called two-sided markets. So you have these companies, whether it's Amazon or Apple or Facebook, you know, who are dealing with both consumers on the one hand and other third parties that are selling through their platforms on the other hand. And so today's ruling at least stands for the proposition that, you know, if you're a platform company, even if you didn't set prices on something that you're selling, that you're potentially open to suit. So that could, you know, potentially be a problem for other platforms. I mean, Facebook has been criticized heavily for privacy-related matters, obviously. And then people say, look, they're a dominant monopoly, and it's a problem because people don't like Facebook, but they don't have anywhere else to go, and we need competition in this space. So, I mean, you know, there are antitrust arguments there, but they're of a different flavor than the kind of thing that the Supreme Court ruling tackled today.
All right. Stephen Nellis of Reuters, you see it similarly?
Yeah, I would largely agree. And I would say that what we're really talking about here is, you know, the ability of a company that controls a platform to set the toll that it takes from people passing over that platform and the kind of control that it has over actors who are on that platform. So in that sense, the better analogy here would probably be Amazon, which, you know, when you go on Amazon and you see those millions and millions of products, only a small handful of those are ones that Amazon is actually stocking. The rest of it is stuff that's sold in a way that Amazon is basically providing warehouse space and website space and a way for that to get to market to you. That's the much closer analogy here in the big tech world. The key difference there is that those sellers are literally setting the price that they're willing to offer on that website, and you're paying it, versus here where it's a much more indirect process of Apple says you've got X number of prices that you can charge for an app and pick one of them, and the developer has to pick that. So that's mm-hmm. kind of the more direct analogy here. But certainly at a higher level, to pull out of the legal specifics, what we're looking at here is, you know, the power of a platform that two sides, one, the consumer, and two, someone who wants to sell something to the consumer, or in the case of Facebook, say something, communicate something, show something to the consumer, and what those two parties have to do and what kind of control the platform has over either of them. And certainly there's a similarity in that, you know, Facebook as a consumer, you have a lot of choice, but the folks who are on the other side of that, the folks in the media business or trying to get things to that consumer on Facebook, or the app developer trying to get something to Apple, or the seller on Amazon trying to get something to the customer, all have a very different view of the situation.
Stephen, thank you. Really appreciate your talking with us. From Reuters, tech correspondent Stephen Nellis. From the Wall Street Journal, legal affairs reporter Brent Kendall. We're going to continue this conversation focusing on the call by the co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, for the company to be broken up. We have a pair of guests with different perspectives on that who'll be with us momentarily. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Coming up later this hour on Air Talk, if you're someone who has endured some kind of a terrible attack by someone else, maybe it's physical, maybe it's some sort of financial crime that was devastating, that it left you in a terrible financial predicament, something very, very seriously harming of you, and you reached the point of being able to forgive the person. I'd like to hear how you got to that point. This in light of Congressmember Steve Scalise, who was shot as he was out practicing with his fellow members of Congress, a baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia, almost 2 years ago. And Scalise saying he's having a very difficult time forgiving the man who shot him. That man was shot and killed by police at the scene. But after talking with the pastor of an African-American church that was burned down in a bigoted attack, who talked about the importance of reaching forgiveness, Scalise said he's going to keep that conversation going, that that's where he wants to get, is being able to forgive his attacker. I'd love to hear your account, if this is something that has happened to you, that or maybe someone close to you, something very terrible happened and you've had a tough time finding the ability to forgive, or you were able to break through to reach that point. That's later this hour. Right now, we continue our conversation about antitrust law and its application to tech. In a piece published last week in the New York Times, Chris Hughes, the co-founder of Facebook, said the government has let Facebook grow too large, and that Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, has amassed too much individual power as the head of that company. Chris Hughes cited a 2018 Pew Center survey finding 2/3 of U.S. adults use Facebook, and said that many don't realize that the company owns 2 other major social media platforms, Instagram and WhatsApp, on top of Facebook. So the question is, is Facebook running afoul of antitrust law or not? Should it be required to sell off the companies that it's acquired? With us is Einar L. Haig, who is professor at Harvard University School of Law and former chairman of the Antitrust Advisory Committee to President Obama's campaign. Thank you so much, Professor L. Haig, for joining us. You agree with the contention of Chris Hughes?
I do think he's right about the acquisition of Instagram and WhatsApp. It seems to me that those did not get challenged mainly because of an analytical mistake. The mistake is that they thought that since they're giving away the services for free, that you had to define it as a merger in the advertising market, because that's what sold for dollars. But the thing is, in these markets for things like social media and photo sharing, the currency really is not dollars, it's data. So they're selling services in exchange for our data, and the intrusiveness of the data and the amount of the data is the currency that's charged. And basically, if you monopolize a market by combining the two leading, say, photo sharing platforms, you're going to be able to charge more data, more higher intrusiveness of data, and more of the data acquired from us. If we had more competition, then he wouldn't be able to have such a monopolistic overcharge in the data exacted from us for the services.
And how do you determine that threshold where it lies? Is that a market share issue, or is it something a little bit squishier than actually, you know, percentage of user participation?
I think it is a market share issue, and the big problem was the market definition that led the agencies to pass on attacking those mergers in the past. So they thought the market should be defined as the percentage of advertising sales, and that's smaller because, you know, Google also sells advertising, for example, in competition to advertisers with Facebook. So in that market, they're competing with each other. But in the market for photo sharing, Google's not a major competitor with Apple, but Instagram is. So in that market, I think you could tell that these were two very direct competitors, and if you allow them to merge together, you're going to eliminate the biggest competitor each of them had in the marketplace.
We're talking with Harvard Law School professor Einar L. Haig, about whether Facebook is so big at this point it should be broken up by the federal government, as Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes contends. He also commingled into that piece a call for the federal government to establish a commission that would oversee what sort of speech would be acceptable for Facebook. Not necessarily the same issue, but Professor, your thoughts about that?
Well, that's a more difficult question. That has to go with, I think that's a general issue of whether when you have a platform for various expression, should the private firms be able to regulate the speech that occurs on it? I mean, some ways that gets you out of the First Amendment issues of having the government involved. On the other hand, it raises worrisome questions about having one powerful private entity decide what can be said and what can't be said. So I think that's another reason to emphasize, to the extent we can, instead of having more market competition, because the best remedy would be to have different platforms that we can turn to avoid noxious speech, rather than to empower one private enterprise with the ability to regulate speech. Facebook may be doing it quite benignly currently, but there's no guarantee that that's going to be the case in the future.
Also with us from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, VP for Strategy and Senior Fellow, Ian Murray. Thank you very much, Mr. Murray, for being with us. What are your concerns about the federal government interceding and breaking up Facebook?
Well, I do worry that there is a big problem of market definition here. When you try to define the market for social media, it's a very nebulous concept. It's made up of so many different things that shift along with fashion. For instance, the professor talked about photo sharing as the major market. There is an app that has now been downloaded over a billion times globally, which is all about sharing short videos, which is where photo sharing seems to be going. So that actually now has more global installs than either Facebook or Instagram. It's called TikTok, and it hasn't really come into the American market much yet, although Jimmy Fallon, I believe, is a big fan of it. But my daughter was just talking about the other day and how she was thinking that she might actually switch some of her activity to that. So these markets can change very, very quickly. So I don't think that the slow-moving process of the federal government trying to get involved in solving a market issue that the market is actually solving really helps anybody.
Well, and where Facebook has, it seems, the biggest control is in social media with its traditional product. And, in a case like that, can competitors come in and essentially uproot Facebook at the bread and butter of what it does? Is that still possible?
Well, we saw that that happened with Facebook just completely decimating MySpace. Pinterest has been gaining users hand over fist recently. Facebook has been losing market share. There are other upstarts like MeWe and Minds that could move into the Facebook space. I think we need to let the market solve this problem.
All right. Einar L. Haig, your response to that there's still enough competition from things that haven't even been created yet.
Well, I think it would be good to let the market decide. The trouble is with mergers, it's not being decided by the market. It's being decided by acquisition. So, the market might have shifted more to Instagram if Facebook hadn't acquired it. I mean, imagine if MySpace had acquired Facebook in the very beginning and prevented its alternative method of having social media. That's the problem. It'd be better to have these different methods compete with each other. And one thing we're losing is not only more intrusiveness of data being charged, but we're losing market innovation by allowing dominant firms to be able to purchase innovative upstarts rather than compete with them.
Professor, what about the idea that one of the things that creates these startups is that there's capital that investors are willing to put into it with the idea that they might be able to launch it as an IPO down the road, or it might be acquired by another company and then they'd be able to cash out. And that drives a lot of innovation, the willingness of venture capital to go into good ideas. And that if you made it more difficult for those acquisitions to occur, you might actually dry up some degree of that investment. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I think we want to preserve efficient incentives to create startups, but not anti-competitive motives to create startups. So to the extent that profits derive or the anticipated profits derive from the possibility that they might outcompete the incumbent and have a better product, that's all to the good. And that's actually protected by antitrust enforcement, particularly against exclusionary conduct that a dominant firm might engage in to stamp out these startups. But when the anticipated profits come from a merger that prevents them from competing with each other, that's not an efficient incentive for creating startups. That's just sort of a more like a protection racket. I'll compete with your monopoly unless you pay me off, and then there's a sharing then in the anti-competitive profits rather than really leading to more innovation and competition.
Professor Einar L. Haig, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. Law professor at Harvard Law, and Ian Murray of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, VP of Strategy and Senior Fellow at CEI. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. So coming up in our next couple of segments, it's just you and me. We're opening up the phones, so I definitely want your input. If you're someone who experienced some sort of devastating attack, physically, emotionally, financially, something that was really a very, very serious harm, have you been able to reach the point of forgiving the person who did you that wrong? Congressman Steve Scalise was nearly killed by a gunman at an Alexandria, Virginia baseball park where Scalise was practicing with his fellow members of Congress. Scalise says he's having a very, very difficult time forgiving the man who shot and seriously injured him. If you're someone who has endured some sort of grievous attack, is that something you continue to struggle with, or have you been able to turn the corner and forgiven the person that did you such grievous harm? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. We'll be back right after this live update from Tammy Trujillo. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who wrote and created the first season of the darkly comic thriller Killing Eve. Phoebe Waller-Bridge with Terry Gross on Fresh Air here on 89.3 KPCC. I was so struck by this story when I saw it Friday. I knew I wanted to talk with you about it on today's program because it's a chance for us, without even necessarily any experts, just to share personal experience about for those listening to the program who've suffered some sort of devastating event to yourself or to someone very close with you, how you've wrestled with the issue of forgiving the person that did it. And or maybe you came to the decision you didn't want to forgive, that you are holding on to the anger, the hurt that you experienced, and you don't necessarily see the value of reaching a point of forgiveness. But I was struck by this in the story of Congressman Steve Scalise. He's the number two House Republican leader, and he represents a district in Louisiana. You might recall a gunman arrived at an Alexandria, Virginia baseball diamond just shy of 2 years ago and opened fire on the members of Congress and staffers who were having the baseball practice. And Congressman Steve Scalise was very seriously wounded. He nearly died and has had a long road rehabbing from that. He still undergoes physical therapy, walks with a cane. He had to have multiple surgeries. And Scalise and Vice President Mike Pence visited the pastors and lay leaders of three predominantly black churches that were burned in arson attacks that have been connected to hate crimes. The suspect who was arrested in the case is the son of a local sheriff's deputy. But Scalise disclosed last week that I still have to address forgiveness for the shooting 2 years ago. It was really good to talk to one of the pastors of the churches, kind of get an understanding of how to get to the point of forgiveness. Scalise went on and said, I've never internally formally forgiven the shooter from the baseball shooting. It's something I've struggled with as a Catholic. I mean, part of my faith is forgiveness, and I'm working to get there. Now, later, an aide to Scalise identified the pastor with whom Scalise was talking as Gerald Toussaint, who was the pastor of Mount Pleasant Baptist Church in Opelousas, Louisiana. That's the church that Scalise and Vice President Pence visited. Scalise said that Pastor Toussaint agreed to talk with him again, and the congressman said, his faith is surely helping me in my faith. So again, if you're someone who has endured some sort of attack, whether it's physical, whether it's a terrible emotional attack, a friend or family member did, how have you dealt with that in terms of seeking forgiveness? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Victor, where are you calling from?
Are you speaking to me right now?
Yes, Victor. Where are you calling from?
I'm from Alhambra, California.
Alhambra. Okay, very good. Victor, please share your story.
Okay, basically, on Friday, February the 13th of 2009, I was with some friends, and we're supposed to be having a good time. We're, you know, went out to dinner, and then we're going to go bowling. But during the dinner, my friend got upset over some personal reasons, and that carried on into our evening. And basically, we're set to go out and have a good time, but a fight broke out. And he came up, and he grabbed me from behind the neck and put me in a sleeper hold, thinking he was going to subdue me. And he squeezed so hard, and he didn't know what he was doing. And my trachea, my esophagus, my vocal cords, everything shattered. And I woke up, and I was like, I can't talk. Previous to that, I had a pretty good voice. Anyways, I thought I would heal. I never did. I befriended, I mean, I'm not longer friends with him. But what happened was I was angry. And
understandably.
Yeah, every day I wanted to sing, I would cry because it was something that would, you know, even if I entertained myself, it would bring me great joy. And it's like losing a wife or a body part. I would often say I'd cut a finger off to get my voice back.
So, Victor, how have you been able to reach the point of forgiving him for doing that?
Yes, finally. It took me a long time.
What got you to that place?
So, basically, I became a born-again Christian, and I was church-hopping with Dr. Lee. He's my mentor, and we went to a few churches, and probably about like, you know, this is like the fifth church we went to. And we went to Church of the Living Water in Glendale, led by Pastor Tony, who is from Iran. And he gives a sermon in four different languages, you know, English, Farsi.
Wow. Yeah. And Victor, I want to get other folks in the conversation, but I appreciate you sharing that it was your faith. It was that spiritual epiphany for you that enabled you, and also through a mentor, to get to that place. Because interesting, Congressman Scalise is talking about Pastor Toussaint as someone he's going to be talking with in the future. Toussaint's church burned down in that alleged hate crime. Talking about the importance of forgiveness for the pastor and members of his church and for Congressman Scalise getting to there as well. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Richard in Fountain Valley says, I think it's important to examine whether it is necessary to forgive someone. I don't think it's black or white, where either you forgive or hold the anger. You don't have to hold that anger or even forgive someone in order to move on. You can move on beyond it by letting the anger go and remembering you can't control what's happened in the past. Thank you for that, Richard. 866-893-KPECC. B.B. Steve writes on the page, my nephew was shot 9 times in the Columbine incident. Because of that, I've stayed aware of how the various families, many of whom lost a son or daughter or sibling, the shooters are both dead, but the parents of the shooters have paid a very steep price for what their 2 sons did. It's been interesting to listen to my nephew over time. Even within the first year, he was able to have true forgiveness of the life-altering impact of the 2 boys, and his life is full and happy today. It took my sister years to start to not blame the parents of the shooters, but she's made a lot of headway. Other parents of kids who died, some have channeled their pain into forgiveness and trying to help others or stop repeats. Others, not so much. B.B. Steve, thank you very much for sharing that extraordinary attack. I appreciate you sharing that on the Air Talk page. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Janelle in La Palma, please share your experience with forgiveness.
It's been a long and heavy, grief-stricken road, Larry, for our family. We've been enduring a cold case, unsolved murder, for the past 48 years.
Oh, my goodness.
There's been no suspect. There's been no, resolution. And it was my mother's mother. So my maternal grandmother was murdered in her home in Huntington Park in 1971. And law enforcement has been very challenged by trying to find suspects. So we've had no one to forgive. There's a phantom out there somewhere who knows who did it, but we don't know. And over the years, it's also been frustrating dealing with law enforcement because they kind of, in their own frustration, are sick of us calling and asking questions. And so we've just been enduring this 49-year-old grief. And it's very heavy. It was heavy, especially yesterday with Mother's Day. It was my mother's mother, and she passed away a few years ago. And
yeah,
she had to live with no mom, for 44 years of her life.
And the lack of resolution, too, Janelle. And I wonder, can you imagine if, because they do solve now some of these cold cases because of new technology and DNA and the like and the ancestral registries. Do you, if a killer or a strong suspect was identified, do you think that having that degree of closure on at least who did it might help you be able to forgive the person or not?
I think so. I think that I'm a strong enough person and a giving enough person to be able to even reach out a hand. I want to know why. I want to know, why this sweet, innocent woman, why did you do this to our family? So I have questions for the perpetrator, but I do think I could forgive.
Janelle, I appreciate you sharing that family tragedy and the tremendous emotional challenge of having the case unsolved for nearly 5 decades. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Share your thoughts about forgiveness and how you got to that point, if you did, or if you want to forgive someone who did you some terrible, terrible harm or a family member or friend. What's the obstacle to that? Or if you want to make the point you're not seeking to be in a place of forgiveness and the reasons for that, that's fine too. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking about forgiveness. I saw this story about Congressman Steve Scalise, who was shot nearly killed when he and fellow members of Congress and their aides were doing a baseball practice. It was a morning practice right outside D.C. nearly 2 years ago. And Scalise talking about the struggle that he's having forgiving the man who shot him. Now, he never had a chance to talk with the perpetrator because the shooter was shot and killed by police at the scene where he carried out the attack. So in that sense, there's no closure for Scalise, but he really, as a person of faith, wants to get to that point where he is able to forgive the man who shot him. And he said the conversation with the pastor of this predominantly African-American church in Louisiana, who had his church burned down in an alleged hate crime, it's the pastor who's able to talk with him about how he's forgiven the arsonist and about the importance for Scalise to forgive the man who shot him. And they're going to have an ongoing conversation, according to the congressman. So my question for you is, do you have something where you endured a tremendous loss and you've had a difficult time forgiving someone or not? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Allie in Glendale, share with us what this has meant for you.
Hi, Larry. Well, when I was a young girl, I was molested and raped for many years, and I spent years in therapy, and they all talked about forgiveness and forgiving the person who had hurt me, and I found it really, really difficult, understandably. I'm not a religious person, but I knew that forgiveness was important, and it was just eating me up inside. And I finally found a therapist who talked to me about forgiving myself and how it could just work wonders. And I never felt better until I learned how to forgive myself, and I'm still struggling with that. But I think that that's a really important thing that's been missing from some of the calls lately, is that a lot of times we can hold on to guilt in ourselves, and forgiving yourself is just life-changing.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in a circumstance where you're talking about this, and I don't know whether this was a trusted person in your life or what the circumstances were. I know it can be very complicated emotionally, but the point you raise is such a good one about that ability to forgive oneself. If for some reason you're blaming yourself for something that was no fault of your own, do you feel like in the case of the person who hurt you, that you do desire to forgive that person, or do you feel like that's not important to your emotional well-being?
I think you hit it exactly right. I don't think it's important to me. I think some people are just, I don't think that they would forgive, they would apologize if they had the chance. And I don't feel any need to forgive them. I think that forgiving myself for not being able to stop things and not understanding what was happening and getting rid of all that guilt that somehow I was to blame is the most important thing.
All right. Allie, I appreciate it. And it's also wonderful to hear about the progress that you're making as you deal with this terrible experience as a child. Thank you so much. Allie in Glendale. Let's talk with Corey in Westwood. Corey, how has your effort to forgive played out in your life?
We had a situation where my grandmother was being taken care of by our aunt, and she separated us, our side of the family, from my grandmother for over a year, and then we got a phone call after a year that said that she was in the hospital and dying, and that we had hours to get there to see her. And she was across the country in Florida. I was here in L.A. My sister and I hopped on a plane. And I basically made it there in time to see her last breath taken. My mother tried to have charges brought up against my aunt, but because of the way that she died, it was her.
I'm sorry, Corey, we're losing. I'm so sorry that we can't continue with that experience, but I'd be interested to hear how your family dealt with this. Corey writes on the page, my mother was hit with a cinder block thrown over an overpass during a family road trip when I was in middle school. She survived, thank God, but the persons involved were never found. I actually blame the state government where it took place, that it was not properly barricaded. It's hard to forgive the people in charge for that. That's Corey writing on the AirTalk page. Let's see. Mopjack writes, I wonder if it's sometimes easier to forgive a very serious offense than a more minor one. A serious injury is so hard to carry around, it almost becomes necessary to forgive and move on, whereas a less tragic event seems to fester and get worse because it doesn't carry the weight of a serious offense. Well, AirTalk listeners, so smart. Mopjack, that's a really, really interesting point. JP writes on the page, I share the representative's Christian perspective and value others too. But for Christians, the need for God's mercy is universal. It's not easy in the face of things like mass shootings, but Christians cultivate a growing appreciation of God's love and mercy. Read Romans 12. That's JP on the Air Talk page. Lucille writes on the page, forgiveness can be highly overrated. Revenge can be good for you. Scientifically documented now, she claims. In some cases, it's best to exact revenge when feasible and move on. I think the problem there, Lucille, is that at least in the attacks that I see or that I hear about, revenge is very, very rarely possible. And the people that extract revenge often pay a very serious price, legally or otherwise, for doing that. And it often ends up in an escalation. You know, how many multiple gang shootings have we had where it's because of retaliation for the attack that, you know, someone close to the person who's a victim comes back and carries out a shooting crime, and then someone on the other side comes back again. And Gretchen, Shabazz in Inglewood says, the conversation should draw a line between forgiveness and accountability. That's a very good point. Sometimes people take accountability for what they do, and sometimes they don't. And that can even make it more difficult if they don't to provide that forgiveness. Thank you for joining us on Air Talk. Have a great afternoon. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10:00.